If you're not learning and adapting, piss off out the marketing industry. Hi, I'm Steve Rick.
And I'm Tim Elliott.
And welcome to the RE of Marketing podcast.
A podcast where we rethink, replay and remark on all good things to do with branding and marketing. Repetition is good. I had that thought earlier in the week. Sometimes you just have to do the work for a bit, like repeat the work. Do the same. Stop inventing new stuff and just do the stuff. Just do the stuff you know until it stops being good. Repetition is all right. Just do the work for a bit and you'll get known for doing that work, right? We have to do 3 million podcast episodes and then we'll get the label of podcaster. Maybe not 3 million.
3 million? Wow. That's...
might be excessive. 3 million seconds of podcasts. I don't know how long that is.
10 seconds. a calculator to work out how many episodes that is.
I've not done it, but we may have passed it. I'm not a maths guy. I'm not even going to attempt it.
Audience
can send us annoying tweets and we'll go, what was that about? Why are the people angry about that thing? What are they having about 3 million seconds for? I don't know. What are they on about in that episode? But anyway, on to the episode, on to the mild rambling introduction to the episode. So we're jumping on the special one because there's an interesting thing that happened in the marketing space. The king of grumpy old marketers, Professor Mark Ritson, from Offer Marketing Week fame and Festival of Marketing and all that sort of stuff.
He does write really good posts.
Oh my God, like, he's good, right? He's good.
Yeah, but agree or disagree with him, he gets you thinking.
And he likes, you know, he likes a swear and it's good. It's good. So he did a webinar for Marketing Week, the big bit of industry press that we have, the most prestigious bit, I would say, where he designed his marketing monster, right? And his marketing monster is like what was that old story that they made?
Frankenstein,
yeah. So he made a marketer out of all these little bits of marketer. And actually, it's really good content because he used a character out of a film to represent each character trait, which we're not doing today because he's got a far more technical team than we have behind us.
Right. do you think he's actually sat down and wrote that, or do you think he's gone to somebody? Can you find out a character that suits this?
Well, I don't know, but he delivered it like it was his, which is the important thing.
Yeah, he's got a tone of voice. He's got a good tone of voice.
Yeah, and it was so what I thought would be interesting is to run through these 12 traits of an effective marketer.
Okay, and I haven't heard these traits.
You haven't heard these traits? Like a pop quiz.
Yeah, our pre-chat before hit and record for this podcast, which we're doing through Zoom because of COVID still. Tim mentioned this to me and said, I'm just going to do a pop quiz with you. So
we are.
Let's see what ramblings fall out.
As if by magic. So like to create an effective marketer today, right,
mm-hmm.
you need a core set of skills or a set of traits as Mark Ritson has put out there into the world. And I thought they were really good. I have affinity with a lot of them. I've done a few talks in the past, pre this episode, of like the 10 rules marketers should live by. And there were similar things, right?
Okay, good. Similar things
down the line. So I thought, oh, that's quite good. Maybe I'm a little bit Mark Ritson in my brain. Or maybe he's just infiltrated my opinion on stuff. I don't know. But here we go, right? We're going to run down these 12 things, quick fire discussion on each one. So the first trait of an effective marketer was empathy.
Right.
So is empathy an agreeable trait with an effective marketer? So I think, to give you time to think, I reckon all good marketing starts with some kind of empathy, some kind of diagnosis, some kind of research looking at the thing. So I would say empathy is... I don't think they're in a vital order, by the way. I just think, you know, they're common traits. But I think a good marketer should have the ability to be empathetic. What about you?
Completely, 100% agree. And it's being used a lot at the minute. The word's been bandied around. It's almost a fashionable word for marketers at the moment, empathy. But as we said in episode one, I can remember us saying this, you know, good marketers are the voice of the customer.
Yep.
So you've got to have real clear empathy of what that customer wants, what they understand, what pains you're trying to take away from them for them. So, yeah, it's definitely a trait that's needed in a marketer. Definitely. Yeah.
You made a good point there as well. I think empathy is becoming one of those words that makes me cringe, like authentic. Of course you're being authentic. Why are you not being authentic?
Like, it's like the word authentic. You don't want to hear it anymore, the word empathy, because it's just been overused and people don't use it in the right context.
This is it. It's overused, misunderstood, misused all the time. But I think
as it's so many pieces of terminology in marketing that happens to. So, you know, I class myself as a propositional marketeer. People do not understand what the word proposition is. And I've had this argument for 5 or 6 years. And empathy is fast becoming the new unprecedented proposition, whatever the new buzzword is for the moment.
Yeah. I'm going to bring up a Gary Vee quote, which I don't usually do. But love him or hate him, sometimes it comes out with a pearl of wisdom. And he said, marketers ruin everything. And I think it's really true. Absolutely true. We ruin everything. This is just a case. So we're going on to number two, right? Empathy,
number two.
We agree with. Good. Number two is curiosity. So how to ask a good question. And he backed this up with content on asking what, how, why, and whether. Like, always question stuff. Always be curious. I think, again, he's bang on. I'm a big fan of curiosity to help you discover a bit more creativity.
Every marketer should be curious. I think there are people who take it too far, though. I can't get curiosity killed the cat out of my head.
No.
But
like if you think, 80s band, right?
Yeah, the 80s band, exactly. But if you... I've worked in organisations, right, where marketing were really good and then got a really bad name really fast because all they did was ask questions and never produced.
Yes. So this is why
they became over curious. You should ask the relevant questions. You should ask the right questions, but then make an action out the back of it. Because if you don't make the action, you just become somebody who questions or is curious all the time and doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah, I've come across similar thing where they became so stuck at asking good questions and trying to find the answer, right?
Yeah.
It, like, the curiosity paralysed them.
Yes.
And they were just going, really, I've just got loads of questions I can't answer. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter. Marketing,
forget Gary Vee, that's a TE one. In curiosity paralysis, curiosity is a thing.
Boom.
Curiosity paralysis is brilliant.
New label to overuse and misunderstand people. Yeah. Curiosity paralysis. You can have that one on me. Just tweet either me or Steve.
Next time you're sat with your CEO or your MD or you're consulting with somebody, if you use curiosity paralysis, you just have to put in brackets afterwards from this podcast.
Yeah, and that's it. And then maybe if you tweet that out, maybe when we have merch, when we're famous podcasters, when we have merch, we'll send you a mug with our faces on. And it'll
be yeah, I mean, my wife at the minute, she's going to start making T-shirts because she likes that type of thing. And I might just get one that says curiosity paralysis on it.
Yeah, I've got curiosity paralysis and people are like, that's very cool. You would get some intelligent people talking to you in the bar when you're like from quite far away, obviously, because still,
yeah, good. Good.
You know, but curiosity number two, wicked. Number three is big picture thinking. I think we have to, as well as represent the customer, drive long-termism throughout an organization, because I think some departments struggle with long-termism, or it just doesn't come naturally in their role in the machine. So I think definitely big picture thinking, you've got to set that long-term goal, otherwise people are stuck in the micro. I think
it's a really, yes, I think yes for a lot of marketers, for people who are interested in strategy in the future, and also being very creative. But actually, I don't want a big picture thinker for somebody who is classing themselves as a marketer and looking after, I don't know, Twitter or content calendar. You know, do I need a big picture thinker at that point? I want somebody who's going to push boundaries, but I don't want somebody who's going to break boundaries, in honesty.
Okay, interesting.
You want somebody, it depends on the size of organisation in a lot of cases, but if you've got, you know, brand in place already, you want people to work to brand to help your authority in growing your brand. If you go too big picture thinking at that point, it could actually be harmful towards it.
Yeah.
But everybody should have that. As a marketer, you should have that curiosity in big picture thinking anyway. You should be thinking, what's the next big thing that's coming?
Yeah. And I think if they go back to episode one, where we broke down the marketing department, that's not the right episode, apologies, people. It might be episode
that was the right episode.
Like you broke down the marketing department into roles or outcomes or something. And some of those are tangibly short-term sales activation-based stuff, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I 100% agree. Number four is interesting, though, right? This one got me thinking when Mark Ritson said it. So, comfort with imprecision. So, they're happy to estimate and declare and communicate when they're making assumptions. Ooh. So, you've got to be happy with imprecision. You've got to. I.
That's a dream, though, isn't it? That's all what we all want. Yeah, we don't want to be accountable to a number and a figure or a KPI.
That's what I want. I think it's like relates to a thing that I say quite a lot, where you need both the freedom and the specificity of thinking, right? You need to be able to do both. And I think this represents having a bit of freedom of thought going, I think this is a good idea. We're going to have to, like, the proof is in the pudding somewhat.
I think we can be very... You know, I think all marketers, I think every job role in this world, or everybody works in marketing or non-marketing, especially commercial, comfort with imprecision, everybody would love.
Yeah.
But it's not the way of the world, is it?
I don't know. I think people measure stuff just because they can measure stuff, and there's metrics that are kind of
irrelevant. But that provides accountability to a lot of people. So...
Yes.
Think of your sales team. There will be KPI to make X amount of sales, or have been introduced X amount of people over an X amount of time, and then they will achieve their bonus from it. That is a hard measurement.
Yeah.
So how do you, to have something harmonized across marketing, you've got to put some form of measurements in. Yeah. And being, you know, not being, having precision measurements there means there's a lot to... that you can navigate around. And I think from an ideal, you know, and I think this is where Mark Ritson's coming from, just from the first fourth, in that ideal Frankenstein monster, if there was no such thing as imprecision, that would be brilliant, because it means that you go out and do everything and test everything to work what worked best. But to receive funds to go out and do things, you've got to be able to measure against it to prove that it's working.
That's interesting. I took a slightly different line from that, as not to be constrained by the measurement. You know what I mean? Not to just focus on achieving a target,
But you've almost, I think that's where we'd all love to be. But if you're sat there inside an organisation as the head of marketing or the director of marketing or a CMO, whatever you are, your rest of your C-suite's going to look at you and hold you accountable to that measurement.
And I think it's a super tricky one, that imprecision and happy to estimate, because, like I say, a lot of non-creative departments, which is a whole, like, which might be a misnomer, but a lot of the other departments are focused on, like, production of the thing, and sales and finance are 100% focused on not estimating stuff. Like, don't estimate.
In a way, this whole thing is going, can we be the only department who's not really measured properly? And do you from a marketing background, that would be awesome. You know, we could go and do the best thing. We could do the gut reaction stuff. But because I've worked in organisations like that, it would never work for anybody else.
You do need a marketing-centred organisation or marketing-friendly organisation that trusts marketing to just go, we're going to do a thing for 3 months.
It might
not work, but we reckon it will work. We think
it's interesting to hear other people's thoughts on that one.
Yeah. So it was. So the ability to be imprecise or estimate, like. Yeah, it's an interesting topic, man.
But it's the word imprecise.
Yeah.
You know, comfort with estimation is absolutely fine because it means you're in the ballpark. But being imprecise to me means you could be a million miles away from it.
Oh, comfort with imprecision. Are you happy to?
I mean, if you are imprecise. One of the sides to it is if you do something and it doesn't work, but you predicted X amount to have come through or X amount of people to have landed where and it doesn't hit, then you shouldn't be bothered by that. And I agree with that. Because it means that you've pushed the boundary. You've tried something new.
If you found something that hasn't worked, that is also valuable in marketing.
Yeah, it's hugely valuable.
Okay, cool. Number five, approaching this. So good at making time. So making time is the trait. To make sure marketing is done properly, right? Making time to make sure marketing is done properly. So have time to do the research, have strategic time, have time to deliver tactics to the end of their campaign, for example, and to figure out feedback. So you have to be good at making time for all the stuff that works. We talked about this again in the beginning, that there's a lot of marketing people out there who maybe listen to this that are reactive, right? So in a reactive world, making time is difficult.
Yeah,
you're not in control of the actions you take. You're not in control. It's just a thing. So I 100% agree with this. I was speaking to a potential new client last night who wanted to know what would be a rough 30, 60, 90 days course of action.
Okay.
And for you who knows me and maybe some other people out there, like I'm a strategy guy. So I was like, well, the first 30 days are figuring out the brand, the strategy, the proposition and the research. I was like, well, what channels are you going to use? I was like, I'm not doing anything until that's ready. And they were like, how many blogs are you going to write? I was like, yep, none.
you did that whole thing. Was you putting the phone down at the same time as answering the question?
Sorry, I think my wife's eating the dog. Sorry, bye. Yeah. I think you need to make time, and whether it's as a department, as an marketing organisation within an organisation or an agency, right? You need to. Each project needs to tick the foundational boxes, right?
Yeah, it needs to breathe.
Whether it's you, the individual, needs to make time for stuff, that might not be your role, right? You might.
How do you make time for a lot? You know, there'll be a lot of people, hopefully there'll be a lot of people listening to this who are in a, you know, 9 to 5 or 10 to 6, working in a marketing department, working out what, you know, what the next thing's coming along is, or just wanting to listen to two guys talk about marketing because it's something that they're interested in. How do they go and make time? I think one of the key bits comes back to that way that I would set up a marketing department, is having reactive in-year KPI team versus a future-led team, because that gives you time to think.
Yeah.
And it gives you a reactive element to it.
Do you know,
personally, you've got to set up time for yourself. I've been involved in education for a long time, right? A long time. And everybody talks about CPD and continual professional development. Do you know what? It's still there. There are still courses you can go on. There's still all these different things. But actually, a lot of the skills that you now pick up are outside of formal learning. So there used to be the 70-20-10 model, if you remember that, which is 70% learning, 20% learning online with people, and then 10%, I can't remember what the 10% was. But I think that's now shifted. And I saw a post somebody the other day on LinkedIn saying that they thought it had gone to 40-40-20. Whereas I think we spend most of our time now learning from either podcasts or from posts and shares on LinkedIn or white papers that you've downloaded or whatever it is. That's now your CPD. There is so much information out there because everybody's realized that that an inbound marketing methodology is better than an outbound, that there is so much information out there. You've got to make time to go through that and find the good stuff.
Yeah, I think, like, as a guy who's bar the odd interruption in the last 23 years, worked primarily as a, like, solo or very small, like not being reactive, like scheduling stuff, having a good system and a process of how you work, how you get from A to Z in a project, is super important. Because it's easy to be distracted or reacted to against
form. So did you build into your calendar learning time as such, or research time for yourself?
I have done before. There was me and a mutual friend of ours, Amir, were the only two people I know for a few years that have put reading time into their calendar.
And is that a non-movable thing?
It's a non-movable thing, yeah. Yeah, it's a non-movable thing. I do it now. I've shifted mine from daytimes to evenings when my wife teaches and stuff, because there's no point.
Yeah.
But it's still in there. I was reading a bit before this, actually, on the creative effectiveness ladder from Cannes Lions, which is probably a whole other episode, which we won't go down that thing. But I think... You need to schedule, you need to have a process, right, and understand the backstage process, the work you have to do in order to produce a project or an outcome of marketing, right, to plan it out, needs to take a period of time. Like, it could take, I don't know, it depends on your process, 3 hours, half a day, a week, whatever you want it to do, right? Whatever you have to do. If you have to do research, it's going to be longer. But you need to be able to communicate that to make a project, it takes us a week. So if you want a project launching, you need to tell us a week in advance, right? And it's a battle, right? It's not easy, that.
It's not easy to make time, but it's becoming easier to make time because there are so many different mediums out there now. You know, if you think back 10, 15 years ago, it would have meant reading a book that you'd just bought in Waterstones or WH Smith. Whereas now you've got books you can buy straight away on a Kindle. You've got podcasts you can listen to. You can get audio books. Then you've got snippet, bite-sized bits of content that are floating around on social media all the time. Good companies release different pieces everywhere. I mean, look at HubSpot. Look at how well they release short, bite-sized content that will make an impact in whatever you're doing.
I think, yes, you have to make time, but the most important is the following sentence: to make sure marketing is done properly.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the thing he wanted to say. There could have been one common trait. Make sure you do it properly. Thanks. End of webinar. Yeah. But that would have been a bit short. Right, halfway. Number six, Stephen. Something we've talked about before, I think. You have to have the trait of being able to take a long-term view. And he followed this with a sentence that almost everybody goes too short. And I think it was similar to big picture-y, the way we took it in the early one. And you can look at references like Peter Field and Bennett, who wrote The Long and the Short of It, which is pretty much the marketing Bible. Do you know what I mean? There's a percentage thing. Some organizations are 50%, 50-50 on long and short tactics. Some are 60-40, some are 70-30. It doesn't matter. You do need both, though. So it's an easier yes from me, if I'm honest.
It's easier yes for me. The longer, the better.
Yeah, fine, cool. And seven, it's also a pretty easy yes, which is being able to create short-term moneymakers. So you'd be able to propose and deliver on annual ROI, but understanding that the long-term is still the most important, but it's powered by the short-term actions.
Yes, yeah, completely.
Which is, like we just said in point six, it's the long and the short of it for a reason, right?
Well, nobody's going to believe your long-term view if you're not making the right amount of money now.
And if you're employed, right, you haven't probably got a year and a half without any results in your job.
No, not
to,
at all.
To figure out a 5-year plan. So you do need that. But I like an interesting part in there. He used an annual ROI, because one of Mark Rixon's thing that he talks about a lot, right, is you can have a strategy and a brand strategy that are long term, that builds successful over the future, but your marketing plan can't be more than 12 months in advance because stuff changes too often.
Absolutely. So
the marketing plan, right?
You the short term. 12 months.
Yeah, the short term for him is max 12 months. Who's doing what and when? Get me some wins.
What would your minimum be? That's an interesting question.
I've heard him use campaign examples for kind of 30 days, 3 months is major of it. Like if because he works primarily with big brands like Moët Chandon and stuff like that, right? And like consumer brands, I would say, as a consultant. So a lot of those are, like, just by the nature of the market, who they serve, a lot of those are seasonal. So clothing, food, advertising stuff is definitely seasonal in trends. Like winter food advertising is different to summer food advertising.
Of course, yes.
I think it's seasonal, which is kind of 3 months, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that for me personally, the minimum of a campaign can be 1 month. Anything less than that, you're running the risk of it just not landing properly.
Yeah, you need. I
think 3 months would be perfect. I think if you work on, I actually used to do things on I think we called it, was it trimester? I don't like trimester as a term, but triannual. Sorry, we used to do triannual things. So, but it was all written around the customer's calendar. So don't worry about, you know, measurements internally. Worry about when your customer's likely to buy and have a run into them. Then activate when they're looking to buy or purchase, and then have a slower wind down afterwards to learn from the things that happened during that campaign.
Yeah.
We used to do that 3 times a year.
And I think that works perfectly from and correlates to what Ritson's background is and stuff. I think if you're marketing a product and a service, the timeline is shorter. If you're marketing a business or a brand, it's longer.
Yeah, right. If you're marketing a business or a brand, it's continuous. You're just changing the way that you're doing it.
Yeah, I think it's just that. So, okay, an easy yes, if I'm honest.
Easy yes.
So number eight is a good word, choicefulness. So strategy is about deciding what you're not going to do, who you're not going to target, your position, your codes, your objectives, right? So being able to make good choices, right? Make a good decision.
I'm completely on board with this. Yeah. I'm I've been involved with so many discussions over the last week around people scared at narrowing their focus on a target audience. The more niche you are, the more of an expert you'll be seen to that market.
Yeah.
Your product, your service, your brand is not going to sell to everybody. It's not. If you think it is, it's not. The more that you can understand one core customer type, and the more that you can actually understand one core decision maker customer type, the better.
Yeah.
But that involves making that choice. And it's hard for people to make that choice because they think they're turning something off. The thing is, you're not turning anything off because you never had it in the first place.
Yeah. And I love a strategy quotable, and that definition sentence he used of strategy is about deciding what you're not going to do is wicked for me. I'm going, yeah. Because same as you, I've doing some startup mentoring in the week, and the guy had come up with a great idea for a solution until he got to, oh, we're going to deal with the SME market in the UK. And I went, hold on a second. So I Googled the current state of that, and it's 99.9% of businesses in the UK are in the SME market. I was like, you can't do that. Like, that's everybody.
Yeah, you're selling.
Yes, yeah. Really. Like, you're like to nobody. Like, do people who are coming up with launching a new business model, which will be a good percentage of that. You don't need 20% of 99% of the market to be successful. You need 0.5 of everybody, right? Who is 0.5?
I mean, I don't know what that product or service was, but if you need to be down at a level of going, instead of SMEs, you go SMEs who make shoes in Northamptonshire.
Yeah.
That's
and they make good shoes in Northamptonshire. So
they do.
Northamptonshire. But choicefulness is a definite and an exciting one for me. I quite like that maybe as a future topic as well, deciding what you're not going to do is an interesting thing.
Because I think deciding not what you're not going to do actually helps you really focus on what you are going to do well.
Yeah.
Really well. That'd be a good topic, actually.
Because you could do... like in marketing meetings, you could do, like, go, okay, so what should we do for this? The options are there's 40 million options on my phone of what we could do, technically.
Yeah.
Like, but figuring out what you're not going to do and why is that important, right? It's a good thing. Ritson, I applaud you for number 8. So not that you'll be listening, but hey, if you do, good work.
If you do listen, Mr. Ritson, I love all of them.
Yeah, I thought rubbish. His face isn't saying that, Mr. Ritson, just so you know. Number 9, simplicity and certainty, right? It's an effective marketer's job to simplify the complex. Thought comes first, and the ability to offer clear, concise communication out the back of that thought of what the outcome is very important. So you need to be able to simplify and make certain a thing. Which
that's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's a definite yes.
Yeah, 100%. I'm Steve's a proposition marketer, which is literally his job is in that number 9. So
yeah, pretty much
literally his whole job description is in there. So quite a simple yes from us, I believe.
Yeah, you done? Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number 10, a good one. Creativity. Again, obvious, but how to understand the relationship between creativity and strategy is the subline. Which I think is very good. I'm a big fan of creativity. I think people don't try hard enough. Anyway, aren't ballsy enough with it to have a really creative, effective campaign. But that following bit of understanding the relationship between creativity and strategy, which might make another episode as well.
Yes, definitely.
Thanks, Mark, for this. This is really good stuff.
Creativity's yes, you can learn it, but you've got to be open to learning creativity. The best people who are creative are born with that trait, for me. And I don't think it's a case of being creative. I think there's a word missing out of that, which is recognizing creativity.
Yeah.
And having the balls to back creativity.
Yeah.
It's a key bit for me.
Yeah. I do a lot of creative, like, skills workshops and stuff. And it's one of those words that, like, in our beautiful English language, which is lovely, we have many, many words that mean a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you are creative if you knit pigeon key rings and sell them on Etsy. We are creative. Mr. Dyson and Elon Musk are creative, right?
Oh, no, they're crazy. They're just crazy. They're not creative.
Well, creatively crazy, maybe. But in theory, that's a lot of people, right? That's a broad spectrum of people.
It's a massive spectrum of different people. But, I mean, my passing comment there, that they're crazy. They are, for me, they're not crazy. They are super intelligent and really creative. But people get scared by creativity at that scale.
Yeah.
And they get classed as crazy.
And I think the... You know, there's elements of building a strategy to answer his how to understand the relationship between creativity and strategy, which we will. I've now put into the episode list, so there will be an episode later on this. But how to do that? I think there's parts of a strategy where again, like I said earlier in this chat, like you need freedom, and then parts of it when you need to be specific.
Yeah,
you need both. It's that it's not an either or solution. If you don't have a creative marketing strategy and plan, like, it's not going to work as well.
Here's a question then.
Yeah.
Should you be creative in your strategy, or should your strategy support creativity?
I think your strategy facilitates creativity. So strategy is the compass, the thing that always guides your creativity in the right direction. You can always refer back to it and go, actually, I've got this crazy idea about pineapples on a big lorry. And then you go, actually, that's not in line with the strategy. It's super creative, but you need to run it through the filter of strategy to make sure it's the right creative.
Okay.
It's what I say.
I agree. I do agree with you. But I do think you can be creative in how you go about your strategy.
Okay, I think you need both. And I don't like the marketing. There's no one size fits all solution, right? You'll take all these good bits and you'll apply them in the correct weighting for your situation.
Imagine if you've given the reins for the strategy for your marketing team, for your organization. Let's say it's a middle-sized company, you know, 50 odd people working there, but you're given the task of building that strategy. I think you can be really creative around that strategy. I think you could, you know, a company that size, you could go, do you know, we're not going to do a strategy that's a year long. We're going to do a 3-month strategy and then revisit it in 3 months time. Which might continue to roll over into a year, but actually we're going to go on a 3-month calendar to start with. And that would be a creative approach to strategy, which would then allow the strategy to breed creativity out the back end.
And I think that works really well for people who have a purpose or a cause, right, which is the thing that actually drives them, not the strategy. And the strategy just defines the next bunch of actions they should do towards fulfilling that cause or purpose. Last couple on this lightning fast episode compared to the other one is rule breaking and distinctiveness, right? You've got to have rule breaking. So distinctiveness, differentiation, and in Mark Ritson's words, don't give a fuck about the rules. Right.
So this episode's got a certificate rating of 18 now.
Yeah, sorry. Well, it has got Mark Ritson in it. I think it automatically comes with with that.
Yeah, good.
So rule breaking is the next trait. You've got to be all right with breaking the rules. And then there, you know, there's used a bunch of good examples, like obviously Apple broke a lot of rules in terms of in their early days when they came out on the Jobs, right? They were massively different, right?
They made a computer a different colour. They made the Newton handheld PDA, which absolutely flopped. But that was an early iteration of the iPhone, realistically. They were always trying to break the boundaries of what they were doing.
Yeah, and I think, I think, again, rule breaking in the context that I'm taking it, in the context that comes from my head, is that a lot of people will be in organisations either as clients or as like in-house marketers, and they'll go, oh no, we don't do that. In this, yes. That's not how we do it in this industry. And you'll go, huh? Like, challenge that. Like, don't believe that. Find it out for yourself, right? But that, break those rules, break those boundaries, whatever you want to do, right? If somebody says, that's not how we do it, well, that's not what this industry does, then I would take a look at that, if I'm honest. I would push that.
Well, the thing is, most rules that are written in place for marketing are going to be wrote by that marketing department anyway. So what are you scared of? Breaking your own rules? That's ridiculous. There is one case where I'd say perhaps rule breaking doesn't need to happen. So there are certain sectors where if you try and break the rules, you'd have distinctiveness, which means you're a great marketer, but it doesn't therefore mean more business. So off the top of my head, legal services, for example, you know, where it's very clear, black and white. So two companies jumped to mind when we said rule breaking and distinctiveness. The first one was Lego again.
Yeah.
Because they're great at breaking the rules of
a Lego toys.
Right. Yeah. But so they're brilliant. They're really distinctive in what they do. They're, you know, even places like Wilkinson's have brought out the Blocks range, which is a lot cheaper version of Lego, does exactly the same, but it still doesn't sell like Lego sells. So they're doing the rule breaking and distinctiveness all the time. But then if you think of somebody like PwC, the consultancy company, they don't break rules.
No.
They're very organized. They're very authoritative in what they do. They stick to their brand guidelines. When I read through their services, I actually get a bit lost about what their services are sometimes, because it's not clear and it's not concise quite often. But look at the size of that of a company. How could we sat here, and how could any marketer sat there, sit there and go, you've got that wrong?
Yeah, and on the flip side, like, I know PwC. In fact, they're not far from me. In fact, they're like 3 miles away. And it was the flip side of their coin, and the same thing, is Cooper Parry, who have done the opposite.
Yes,
auditing people.
And they've done a great job, and their website is outstanding. Like, from a marketing perspective, and us who have got creative brains, we look at that and go, God, that's brilliant. But to your corporate finance market, that might scare them. And actually, you might not need to break it, and you might not need to be distinctive. You might just need to look trustworthy.
Yeah, I think... Do you know what? I don't think it's for everybody. And like Seth Godin says, like, some things aren't for some people, and that's all right. You've just got to be all right with it. Like, if you're going down the differentiated, distinctive, rule-breaking, check me out, we're a bit ballsy and different, like, you are automatically making the choice that's not for a bunch of your market.
Yeah,
but you've got to be all right.
There is nothing wrong with that, because you're going back to that choicefulness piece.
Yeah.
And do you know what? Half of us, and I should think most people listening to this, would be in that rule breaking distinctiveness category. I would love to be in that market more than anything else.
Yeah.
But there will be, I know it will cut out some of the market, which is good, because I don't want all that market anyway.
No, you don't. It's like Simon Sinek, right? You've got to, what's that? You've got to do work with, the thing is not to get people to buy what you sell, but to work with people who believe what you believe, or something, right? Something yeah. around that. Sorry, yeah. Simon, screwed that up. But, you know, you're that one.
if you want to come on and just tell us about it, Simon, please do.
Yeah, yeah, fine. Yeah, join us on the call. That'll be lovely. And the last one. Last one is, again, a simple yes from me, but learning and adapting. You've got to have the ability to continually learn and adapt, evolve and adapt. I always like the phrase evolve, right? Marketing should always be evolving, or at least a percentage of you should be looking to evolve. And you should be doing, like, if you've got a thing that works, don't stop doing it. But always have a percentage of your time. Like Google and 3M and Facebook have 20% of the weeks where you can play with other stuff, right? You can use that as innovation time, whether it's 10%, 20% or over your Friday lunch break, right? I think you should have a tenant to evolve, but learning and adapting, or learning and evolving, is definitely a tick from me, if I'm honest.
If you're not learning and adapting, piss off out the marketing industry.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. You are not needed. Thanks.
That was it. That was the 12, my friend. That was the 12. So we had empathy, curiosity, big picture thinking, comfort within precision, making time, long-term view, short-term money-making, choicefulness, simplicity and certainty, creativity, rule breaking, and learning and adapting. Good.
I think if that was the Frankenstein monster of marketers, it is pretty perfect.
It's pretty good. Any glaring omissions, would you say?
That's a big question to ask.
It is at the end. Sorry about that.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of dead space.
What about to you, the audience? Any omissions from that? You can either review this, like listen back to this, or look at the show notes, or just just Google Ritson's Marketing Monster or Mark Ritson Monster. Hopefully there's not many other search results for that term.
The only thing that I would say on it is I think it's very inward-centred rather than outward-looking. So it's looking what a marketer should be, it's the right list. But actually, what a good marketer does is as we've talked about, we facilitate change with other people.
Yes.
And actually, there's something along the lines of being a facilitator with other core groups or other core stakeholders that I would want to put in there as well.
Yeah.
I think if you asked me to write if this was the perfect traits of what I want to be known as, that's great. But I don't think it works from a salesperson looking at me, and I don't think it works from a finance director looking at me, or even a CEO looking at me. They would want to see something else, which is along the lines of, well, how do you bring us on that journey?
Yeah.
How do we not get scared that you're going to make the wrong choice? How do we get scared? How do you take away that feeling of we might be scared that you're going to rule break all the time?
Yeah. I would be interested to see, like all good marketers, like we've put out this proposition of what a good marketer is. I would like to do some good old fashioned market research and see what CEOs, CFOs, sales, not sales people, ignore them. I know what they think. but see what they think an ideal marketer should be. And I wonder what the correlation should be.
That would be really interesting. That would be a really good bit of research.
It would be a really interesting report that we all us marketers then ignore and carry on anyway.
So the two things we need you to go and find out for us then, as listeners, is you need to get back to us by telling us, is there anything missing off that list, or is there anything that you fully disagree with that's on that list?
Yeah.
And the second one is if you are not a marketer and you've stumbled across this for some reason, tell us if you would interact with that person or if you wouldn't.